Bon dia, and welcome to episode 33, where our guest is the co-author of the book, We Will Lead Africa. She's a beautiful African woman with an unyielding dedication to her plan. A stargazer with her feet on the ground who helped us realize that we are all everyday leaders in our own right. So, please welcome to Kubula, the amazing Sarah Owusu.
Há muito boato, há muita poeira nisto tudo, mas muita poeira.
Oh, meu irmão, me deixe em paz, por favor.
Morto nos cemitérios. Fala, mas ainda não pode entrar assim. Olha lá, pires, petiscos, canvas.
Relação é amor, não é investigações. Você vive a investigar cada dia fez o quê? Porque vocês procuram pior de cada um de vocês.
Ah, só bateu mais duas. Só mais duas. Só para cantar na placa.
Por dia bates quantas?
Por dia. Umas baguelas, assim. Uns 3 litros.
Hi.
You didn't expect me to stop mid-sentence, but I've already introduced you. So, you know, introducing you again is, you know, the other previous guests would start sending us emails and being like, we got one introduction and Sarah gets two introductions.
Right. Okay. No favoritism.
Yeah. You know, try to keep it equal for all, no matter what. Welcome to our platform. And offline, you were saying congratulations. And I don't do very well with compliments. So I'll say it now and say thank you for those amazing compliments where Sarah was talking about this platform and getting different interesting and amazing individuals from different aspects of life here in Maputo, at least. You know, sharing the information that they have to share. Thank you. Thank you for that.
And like take the time to absorb it, right? Like it's a big deal what you're doing. It's a big deal to showcase stories that people wouldn't usually be able to hear. It's a big deal to showcase everyday people who are doing extraordinary things. So, you know, really, really well done. But not just that. I really love to think about how we across the continent can begin to connect the dots where there are people who are doing this really critical work of documenting stories. So I see you guys as spearheading that here in Mozambique. I guess I feel a little bit guilty because I'm not Mozambican. I'm honorary Mozambican.
It doesn't matter. It's not about where you're from. It's about where you're at. Ha!
Oh.
That was my excuse to use that. Yeah, but it's true. It's about where you're at. It's not about where you're from. I believe in that so much because there's a lot of people, even Mozambicans that listen to this podcast that are living in different parts of the world. And sure. They're doing their bit to contribute to those societies. Obviously, being a bit biased, they are Mozambican. So, you know, we always going to want to feed them with things from this side. And I'm sure that a lot of them are homesick. And miss home in some kind of way, especially now with these closed borders and sure. things like that. It's just about connecting because why not? And maybe we can get into this. Like one of the things that I've always spoken to even my colleagues at work, even family members in Moz, is the fact that a lot of, like if you look at our region, like we have a lot of English-speaking countries like around us, neighboring us. And it's quite, what we really find online is a lot of information about Mozambique in English, unless if it's tourism or some scandal or, you know, that's why I like websites like Club of Mozambique that at least you can, if you're an outsider, someone that doesn't speak Portuguese, you can at least have some sort of like update, some news about what's happening here because we have such a massive expat community as well who a lot of them, first language is not Portuguese and would like to know more. Some have left and still want to still feel connected with Mozambique and that, you know, websites like Club of Mozambique, and I'm sure many others are going to follow, is a great way of, you know, the rest of the world being exposed to us.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's a well-kept secret, right? Mozambique, I think, quite often feels like it gets dropped off the map in some ways. And I think a lot of it is to do with language, right? Should I talk a little bit about like how I ended up here?
You can yeah? talk about whatever you want to talk about. So cool. Let's start there.
Yes. So I think it's a story that tells a lot about who I am or who I've become and am continued to become. I often talk about myself as a planetary citizen because I am a Danish Ghanaian who was born in Botswana, but I'm now based in Mozambique and kind of have family spread out all over the place. And I'm always faced with the dreaded, where are you from? No, where are you really from? Kind of question, right? For me, I lived in London for many years before deciding to relocate to Mozambique. I lived in Mozambique when I was a teenager. So I went to the international school here for a couple of years before going back to the UK. But coming back to Mozambique was really a very deliberate and conscious decision. On the one hand, I'd had enough of kind of London life and corporate life. So it was a decision to come and set up my own business and kind of be a freelancer for the first time. But Mozambique specifically was one of the places where, as a kind of a brown multi-nationality type person, I just have always felt very, very comfortable and very, very at home. London is the other place where that kind of like identity, like you just kind of blend in to the crowd. So one of the reasons why Mozambique is so special to me, I think, is because of that. There's so much multi everywhere, everywhere you look, and that feels very much like home.
That's always interesting to hear these stories about people that I call it like global citizen, although there's a brand called Global Citizen. But you being exposed to like so many cultures gives you already like such a big advantage. I feel like in anything, that's why. You know, young kids, I have friends with a lot of parents who have young children that as much as they can, trying to put them into like international schools and trying to put them in learning multi-languages and so forth, because it makes you a richer person. Traveling, yes, is one thing, but you know, when you actually exposed to like languages and cultures, it really molds you much more as a person. And it's such a brilliant sort of thing to have, like going into anything, especially working here in Africa / Mozambique. It's important to have these multi things.
Sure. Right? Yeah. And I think, so I would guess I would identify as a pan-European, pan-African. and that pan-African part is really important. And the move back to base myself on the continent and to focus my work on having an impact on the continent has been really an important decision, but also kind of life-changing and life-affirming for me, right? To reconnect with people I know, family I know, and the stories of African people everywhere. Yeah.
What is one thing that you particularly love about Mozambique? If there was... You talked about being in different countries, you know, you're exposed to different cultures, but like Mozambique, like, yes, you know, you connected to Mozambique, but what is one thing that you love about this country?
Yeah, my mind goes in lots of different directions, right? Some of them are like obvious and cheesy, like the food and the weather and the beaches and the beauty, both of the people and the country, the nature, et cetera. I want to say, like, culture feels really close to the surface here. And I don't know, I've heard some stories of people talk about how Mozambique, Maputo was seen as like the Paris of Africa at one point. And like in ways I haven't really seen in a lot of other countries that I've lived in. I don't know, I think of like Botswana, Gaborone, the capital city, you don't feel culture all around you all of the time. So like here, there's so much live music, poetry, there's like so much literature. And I know that, of course, that exists in all African countries in particular. You know, like it's not to do with that. Here, it just feels that it's very, very close to the surface. And being surrounded by art in that way, right? Like even like the murals you have on the Marginal of Naguib and the Malangatana, huge murals, right? Like you just see it very, it's very, very, it's on, it's painted and written all over the city. And that beauty, I think, is something that is very, very striking to me. And I find it very inspiring to be around.
Yeah, no, it truly is. Like that's one of the great things that people have sort of coming out of the airport and, you know, by Praça de Heróis, and then, you know, you see all this beautiful artwork and, you know, like you said, all over the city. And it's beautiful to see. And it's beautiful to see that also in terms of speaking more about Maputo, that municipality has been open to showcasing these things.
Yeah, yeah. And you see a lot of like younger people as well, right? Like getting into like street art and things like that that I don't feel like you see in... Well, even a lot of whatever Western cities either, right? So I really appreciate that.
And born in Botswana, did you have any memories of that? Like how, like what, did you go back? Do you have family there?
I do. My dad was from Ghana, but he lived there for very many years till he passed away. And so I have two little brothers there. I don't have that much contact with them, but we're in touch once in a while, and I've met each of them one time. I don't go back to Botswana that often. Really, I should, but I have a lot of memories of Botswana. So I guess I was 10 when we left. So I do have memories of traveling, like memories of the desert. Like Botswana is just like mainly dust and cows, right? And then there's like Gaborone, like there's cities along one side, and then there's the Okavango Delta, which if you've never been, like is just a mind-blowingly beautiful
tourism
thing.
Tourism is a big pull for them.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. And they've done a really good job of doing kind of very, I don't know, eco-friendly or, you know, high-end type tourism. But like the rest is just desert. So I remember like baobab trees and seeing snakes and like picking up like rocks, you know, like rose quartz that's just like scattered all over the ground. Like, yeah, it's a super special place. And I feel like because I was born there, I have kind of an affinity to desert and to like the heat of that. I remember traveling in the States later in life and driving through Death Valley and being like, oh, right, okay, desert. Like it feels, that feels right, you know? And I remember coming home to Denmark as a 10-ish year old or even younger. And my mom asking me, you know, am I not cold? And the response, like this, I always hear this from my family, right? The response that I gave at the time was, no, because I have the sun in my belly, right? So I feel like I carry that. That's kind of my Botswana roots.
you then study in Denmark. Was it London? Sorry.
I did some school in Denmark and then I came back here and did some school here. And then eventually did my last few years of school and university in London. So I did a philosophy degree at University of London. So I guess you could say I'm a philosopher.
And you've got a master's in philosophy, right?
I do. I don't know. I don't know what that means.
Hey, we're about to get into some...
philosophy. I don't know. It ruined my life. No, it didn't.
Did you? So, from what I'm hearing, is that it wasn't. It was a road that was a rocky road, or was it something that you sort of did and weren't, and then realized, why did I do that? Or
no, I don't think that's it. I use what I learned in my philosophy degree every single day in my personal and professional life. I am very grateful that I did that degree. But the experience of doing a philosophy degree is somewhat challenging, right? Like, so you go to to class one day and they teach you the all of the evidence for argument A, and then you're completely convinced. And then the next day, they teach you all of the evidence against argument A. And so, like, you have to really learn to construct and deconstruct and throw away what you thought was true and be open to the ambiguous. And I guess in many ways, the thing that still sticks with me is the fact that there just isn't one truth, you know? And I think that's part of why I do the work that I do now, is because I think it's deeply human to confront some of those big questions about, like, who we are, why we're here, what things are and what they mean. And also that all kinds of responses to those questions are valid, and we have to make space for that.
There's always, it's true, like, I can tell a story about, like, how we're recording this episode and how this episode was great. And Marcy can go and say how this episode sucked completely, if it's the two of us. But then there's always, for me, it's like always like understanding the why, mm-hmm. like, and getting into those, like, facts and whatever, like, scenario that it is.
Or indeed not facts, right?
Yeah, or indeed not facts, exactly. Yeah, it's fascinating. I just never. What made you, like, study philosophy? Like, what takes someone to go, like, I want to do philosophy?
I did, in my last few years of school, me and one other person did religious studies. Everybody else didn't do religious studies, but the two of us decided.
And school was here.
No, so that was in the UK. Yeah, UK, okay, so my last few years of school in like strict English boarding school.
I was about to say international school didn't have.
No.
The school I went to, which was South African school, we had Bible studies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So there's some philosophy in there, right?
Yeah.
Because so two of us were crazy enough to decide to do religious studies. And the teacher who taught us the philosophy and ethics of religion. So whilst it was focused on religion, it was very much about philosophical approaches too. So how do you know that God exists? You know, do you know? Can you know? What does that mean for our values and our ethics? What types of choices should we be making about how to live, right? So that was very much his approach. And I guess that was, I think I've always had an inclination for the big questions, but I think that was where it was like, oh, right, like, this is what I want to go deeper into. And I genuinely believe that everyone should do a philosophy degree, or everyone should be taught philosophy, because I think it teaches you how to think.
Right? So you say in schools?
Yeah.
Basically high schools?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing that I do look back on is that the philosophy degree that I did should, in fact, have been called philosophy of English, German, and French philosophers, right? Because they call it a master's in philosophy, but all they taught us was, like, those three. And so, like, a bunch of old white men, right? It wasn't a particularly rich degree in retrospect. And I've had to do a lot of that kind of recovering of knowledge from other cultures and backgrounds.
Nós temos filósofos africanos?
Claro.
Do we?
Yeah, and even like leaders, who? Right? Psychologists and
who?
Yeah.
Psychologists and leaders, and like, even you know, you could write the teachings of Asamoah Michel, and a lot of that would be philosophy.
Right.
Right. So you think of a lot of African leaders, like founding fathers in inverted commas, type, what they spoke about, like, was very philosophical, right? Frantz Fanon are like people that I would read, right? And I think that's part of why the project We Will Lead Africa that we have is because it's so much of it isn't documented and so much of it isn't shared.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was about to ask. That you know, when I So what we're talking about is we lead Africa, and you know, we'll put links up. When I got a hold of the book, what I admire about Africa in general, Africa, African is the fact that, you know, in a lot of aspects, like there's a lot of like things that are not sort of like highlighted, or things that exist, a lot of richness, but a lot of it hasn't been, the wrong word is explored, if you don't want to use that word, but it hasn't been sort of like brought to as a highlight or discovering a lot of these stories. Like one of the things that I feel that talking more from a Mozambican perspective, can't speak for the whole of Africa, but from a Mozambican perspective is, you know, we have a lot of heroes from that are still alive from independence, also that fought through the Civil War as well here in Mozambique. And I feel that like we're not capturing a lot of these stories, a lot of these rich, talking about storytelling, that's what I'm going to get to with what you do. And a lot of these heroes are sadly getting to an age where they're no longer with us and so forth. But we need to capture those stories. I feel like we need to do more to capture these stories, you know, for our future children. We've got kids, you know, I want my daughter to learn about our history, not only from what exists right now, but also today, which is the 2nd of September, 2020, where, you know, we're capturing a story of one of the freedom fighters, Mr. X or Mrs. X, that we can then one day share with the rest of Mozambicans so that it can live in our history, so we can know more about our history and more about these kind of stories. And I feel like more and more that there's other, we look at other countries and we see how they've done them and how they've and the way that they're able to capture a lot of these stories, whether if it's written, whether if it's audio, whatever it is. But that is so rich because it's lived somewhere, and it actually teaches, you know, the next generation, or teaches even our generation of things to maybe look up to and things maybe to never do again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There are so many lessons in it, right? I guess there's something about, and like, there are some broad sweeping statements in what I'm about to say, but I genuinely think of, when I think of leadership, when I think of African leadership or leadership by African people, it is often much more grounded in the relational and in the collective and in community. And so I think that is a different type of a story, right? Where what you hear about leaders, usually it's like the soul, you know, the Lone Ranger leader, the Richard Branson or the whatever, JFK or the, right? Like, and it's all
individual.
Yeah, exactly. It's all in the individual. It's all about the individual. And so I think maybe that's part of the reason why as well, is that I think the story of African leadership is more collective and therefore maybe more complex to tell, right? It's more of a tapestry or a patchwork of stories that you need to tell in order to be able to really capture what it's about.
Eu tava lendo umas histórias do teu livro, mm-hmm. Sarah. And a primeira palavra que veio à cabeça foi uma palavra que era learn. Ano passado houve o prémio do Mark Twain Prize, de Chapelle, e no acceptance speech dele, ele falou, ele usou um termo, uma palavra chama-se criou. It's a French word. E o que quer dizer é que é um termo para os storytellers africanos, não é? Que antigamente nas aldeias tinha alguém que sabia as histórias, sabia os rituais e tinha all the wisdom. Ia acumulando isso e depois passava para os próximos. E era como se fosse a biblioteca ou a livraria daquela vila. And when I was reading the book, it was the first word that came to my mind, foi essa de... Porque, como eu estava a dizer antes de nós começarmos a gravar, o que é interessante é que tens várias histórias e tu não precisas de ler de página 1, 2, 3, tudo seguido. Não é? Podemos jump around. That's what I did. Eu não li todas as histórias, mas li as histórias que eu fui procurar os títulos e as pessoas e the ones that I found that I thought I would find more interesting, né? Então é isso. E é engraçado agora que nós estamos a falar das histórias e de partilhar e não sei o quê, como é que algo que já vem de tanto tempo, uma prática que já vem de anos e anos e anos, como é que hoje, somehow, nós sentimos a necessidade de revive that?
Right, yeah. And like, how can we really leverage the tools that are now available to us, right? To capture what the griot would do, like the story keeper, right? Like, absolutely. I think that is such a critical thing that we have to really wrap our heads around, and not just capturing them, but also like owning our stories, right? And like owning the distribution channels and all of that stuff. If we want to see some of the changes that I think are necessary in the world. But maybe I'll talk a little bit about We Will Lead Africa, and because that's at the core of We Will Lead Africa. Whilst it exists in reality as two books, we do think of it as a movement that is both trying to break down some of the narratives that people have about African leadership, right? Because you'll hear, oh, there's no such thing as African leadership, or you'll hear leadership associated with corruption and all of these other bad words, right? And we know that that's not true. We see people doing extraordinary things all of the time, all around us. And so on the one hand, for us, these books are about capturing that and challenging the narratives that there is no such thing as African leadership and shifting what the contents of that narrative could be. But secondly, it's also about inspiring people, right? So when you pick up the book and you are drawn to a story, we hope that seeing an everyday person, we call them everyday leaders, right? An everyday person who's doing something extraordinary might inspire you to do the same, or it might make you realize that you can start from wherever you are, and that you don't need some title or any kind of authority to be a leader. So that's really the grounding there. But we have, I don't know, we're having lots of conversations now about what the future of We Will Lead Africa might be. But certainly one of the aspects of it would be around how do you convene people to tell stories, right? And how do you bring back some of the storytelling and dialogue technology that is so deeply African, right? Like, we know how to sit in circle and tell a good story, right? In ways that no one else does. So how do we bring back some of that, and how do we really shine the spotlight on all of the awesome things that are going on?
You guys have built a global community with the books. I mean, I've been following you guys on social media and looking at, especially during this time, you've been doing a lot of online and conversations, just like everyone else. But it's very interesting, and you've brought here like volume two for us to look at. And I mean, how do you go about picking who's going to be on in the books? Like, how does that process happen?
So we put out a generic call, right, for stories. And as our community grows, obviously that reaches more people, right? But certainly for the first book, it wasn't easy to get stories. And a lot of the stories that you'll see in the books are either in our network or kind of one, two, three people removed, because we really had to use a lot of the goodwill in our own networks to collect the stories in the first place. So I think that's part one. Part two is that people who are in action and having an awesome impact are really busy, right? Like they don't have time to sit down and write their story, right?
They can record it.
Right,
this
right.
Podcast, well, this,
absolutely, right? And so I think that there's so much power in the potential of kind of connecting all of these different things. But one of the things we did end up doing was we'd have interviews with people, right? We'd ask them to tell their story, and we would document it for them. And in the process, I think what's awesome is everybody finds the process really amazing, right? Taking the time to reflect and to actually realize what you're up to and to say it out loud, it can be really powerful, right? And I think that everybody has a story to tell. We just don't give ourselves enough space, right? And I'll I'll plug a second thing that I'm working on at the moment called Collateral Benefits, which is also about gathering perspectives of African people everywhere. But these are critical perspectives, which are specifically around this moment that we're living in of like COVID-19 plus all of the other strange tensions in the world at the moment.
Yeah.
And these are shorter perspectives. They're only kind of two paragraphs long, exactly because of, you know, how do you get people to sit down and actually commit something to paper? But our tagline is space to think. And so I think that that's something that's really important that we really do have to carve out the time to reflect on who we are, what kind of impact we want to have, what, particularly right now, right? Like, what does this moment mean for us? How do we move forward? How do we make sure that we're imagining a future that's different to what's gone before because it wasn't serving so many of us, right? Like now that we actually have this pause button in some ways that's been pushed, how do we actually really use this moment to bring something new into life? So I think for both We Will Lead Africa and Collateral Benefits, part of what we're also trying to do is to encourage or invite people to take the time to think and take the time to imagine and to think about how they're going to actually bring the future to life, because we can do that by design, right?
It's so important now more than ever. I mean, one of the events that we did last year that you saw the exhibition Moleskin Foundation was at work. Not that I'm plugging it right now.
No, it was gorgeous.
Talk about it because it was fantastic because you know, for me it was an eye opener because I've always been someone that has had one foot in, one foot out. You know, shake it all about. And that's also one of the other reasons why, you know, we started this podcast was and inviting guests is that we're learning as we go along. And what I learned last year was how there's, you know, a lot of really talented young individuals, you know, in Maputo alone. And when I mean like super talented, I mean as in I've learned so much from one or two of them already off the back of that. And I wouldn't have never met them if we had not sort of like put the event together and, you know, actually came in for the workshop. And the workshop was intensive. It was with Simon Jami and all of that. And he opened a lot of...
Intense is the right word.
Yeah, intense. And he unlocked a lot of things with these young people, these young individuals. And yeah, there was a language barrier. You know, Simon doesn't speak Portuguese. And there were a lot of... Portuguese only speakers. It was a challenge, but they got through that challenge. And in the end, it was funny because at the beginning they were wanting to sort of kill him and like throw him off the balcony because like he was pushing and asking some really, really tough questions.
Yeah.
That even me as the sort of moderator sitting in that room, I was like, holy shit. But it's good because it takes you out of your comfort zone, and I look at a lot of people that have like mentors and good mentors that actually like help to push them. A good mentor for me, in my opinion, you know, people can have different opinions, but a good mentor for me is someone that pushes you. So pushes you by challenging you as well, you know, and challenging you to challenge yourself. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. To actually ask yourself the question, the basic things, what do you want? What do you want to get out of doing so and so? What do you plan for like future? Even things that you ask yourself, like your friendship circle, you know, like all of these like different things that actually influence you in your life. But what was great about that program was that a lot of these young people, you know, then had one or two had collaborations off that. So the same thing happened, like they mm-hmm. met each other and then had collaborations off that. But what I saw was an opportunity to start like providing more of these opportunities for more people. So mm-hmm. things like creative hubs is, I think, so important to start having, to start creating these kind of like creative hubs. Like what kind of creative hub? Don't ask me. But I feel like there's a lot of individuals that are feel a bit lost.
Sure.
And I feel especially right now during this time. And it's normal. You know, it's normal. You can feel a bit lost, a bit like disengaged. As much as a lot of things are happening on the digital world and the digital platforms, the connection is just, it's not the same. I've always been a face-to-face person. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's not the same. And a lot of people do feel sort of detached. There's a lot of creative minds, people that think creatively.
Mm-hmm.
People that think, you know, yes, all right, I may not have a job right now, mas eu vou criar essa cena.
Yes.
I'm going to, you know.
100%. And I think like that's part of what we document there. But you're also speaking to my other passion or my the other, one of the other hats that I wear. So like my day job, I guess you could call it, is that I work, I'm an organization development and practitioner and strategist. I work with as a coach and as an innovation specialist, right? And so that means working with individuals and teams and organizations to help them kind of unlock their potential in this way that you're describing, and particularly their innovation potential. But one of the, in that space of thinking about innovation, one of the big kind of, fires under my ass at the moment is to begin to talk more about African innovation, right? Because innovation is often associated just with technology or with something that the guys over in Silicon Valley do, right? Or something that a company needs to do just to unlock growth. But really and truly, innovation is about building the future, right? And hopefully building a future that's much more suitable for all of us. And if you want to see innovation, then you need to go and see like people who are working in rural areas or living in rural areas and who are doing it against all odds, right? Because of the constraints, right? Like the way that they live has taught them to be geniuses at finding other ways around and like thinking the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth thought, as opposed to just going with the first thing, which is something that you have the privilege of doing if you are living in a lot of the West, right? And so absolutely, I think there's really a lot of ingenuity all around us. You had Sarah on last week, who I also work very closely with on innovation and on entrepreneurship. And like we see that every day, right? Of just brilliant ideas that people are taking hold of and then turning into reality despite all of the potential blockers that might be getting in their way. Yeah, 100.
Não, tu agora Sara, falaste de African innovation e falaste in a broader tipo, de tudo. Não falaste de país específico, não falaste de Moçambique, falaste de todos juntos, não é?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things que eu também reparei foi que tu tens várias histórias de várias pessoas. Tens Ghana, Nigéria, Moçambique, pessoas de vários países em África.
Uhum.
E uma coisa que é engraçada é que mesmo eu, ao ler uma história de alguém do Ghana, I can gravitate towards their struggles, porque é muito parecido.
Right.
Podes mudar a localização e talvez um bocadinho da cultura, mas os struggles e o que aquelas pessoas passam parece ser muito parecido com o que nós passamos aqui. So, tu achas que innovation, como estás a dizer, africana, podemos usar coisas que eles fazem lá para o nosso benefício cá e vice-versa? E é essa colaboração que nós devemos ter mais em África uns com os outros?
Oh my goodness, absolutely, right? Like, I think that there are so many solutions that we could be scaling across the continent rather than have some plug and play from wherever, the UK or wherever it might be, right? Because the contexts are so much more similar. Same with India, or, you know, there's lots of places in the world where solutions would be much more relevant in our context than some of the ones that we import. That said, one of the kind of core things or the starting point of innovation is always to really think about the challenge or the need, right, on the ground. So So you would always need to think about how you test the solutions in that particular market. And there's, whilst there's many similarities, there's also going to be many, many ways in which you'll have to adapt it, right? But for sure, I think that we could be collaborating a lot more, and really borrowing from success stories across the continent, so that we can, you know, because there's an urgency about this. Like, we really need to pick it up. We need to go at top speed to find some of the solutions to some of the big challenges that we're facing. We can't keep being left behind. Like, that's not an option. Like, you think about something like education, you can't, if we were to start and say everybody across all of Africa, all the children need from primary education up to secondary education, we need to make sure that they all pass through this, like, whatever curriculum that comes to us from England or Portugal, or I don't know, whatever, right? Like, we need to push them all through that system, and then in 30 years, everybody will be literate. By the time they come out of the school system, the world would have changed so significantly that everything that they learned will be completely pointless, right? So Judith, who's the co-editor of We Will Lead Africa, co-founder, co-editor of the books, she has a virtual reality lab in Nigeria. And she's like, put the Google goggles or whatever they're called on the children's faces, right? So that they can, like, learn anything from anywhere right now, right? Like,
in the moment.
Yeah, and get access to classrooms and get access to, right? Like, bring it to them now, right? And bring it to them in a different way, because we can't just keep... The education that I got isn't going to be useful, right? Even though it was a very privileged education. But, like, the world is shifting so much. The skills we need are so different. Some of them are the ones that you were speaking about, like the multicultural, right? Like, diversity, all of that kind of stuff.
I feel that it's so, you know, we talk so much about IQ. And, you know, for me, what's very important is EQ, like emotional intelligence. So
right.
you being able to, again, be a person that is exposed to many cultures in your life, no matter what age you are, you can be exposed to many cultures, you know, by the age of 15. And that has molded you into a person that you are, right? But being exposed to many cultures is so important because, especially in Africa, where we also speak various languages for one continent, you know, this, when you can even go into tribal languages and so forth, mm-hmm. that's different in every country and similar in some regions of different countries as well. It's important, and that's what makes great leaders, is EQ. Mm-hmm. Great leaders are able to, no matter what, be able to bring it back to earth, bring it, you know, keep their feet on the ground when it comes to not only learning about people's cultures, but also the way you communicate with people. People you don't know, people you're meeting for the first time. That's why, like, I can't remember what the study was, but I'll try to find it and put it in the links. But there was a study about, like, leaders like Barack Obama, for example, like, why... Someone leaders like Barack Obama, Nelson Mandela, and I bring those two because they're probably the most recognizable for their, you know, charisma, charm, you know, when the way they talk. And that also comes with emotional intelligence, like being able to meet someone for the first time and actually, you know, ask them questions about, I can be president or whatever, but... You're a human being.
I can connect, right?
And I can connect with you. And you can actually be like, wow, this guy's present. He's actually asking me this question, you know, like, and sort of bringing it back down. You know, what I have is just a title. And that's just a title.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am first is a human being. And I feel that that's so super important in our continent, especially towards, like, the next generation of leaders need to definitely have and know about that.
Yeah, there's something I've been reflecting on a lot recently, which is about the need for people who would traditionally reject a leadership title or, like, power to actually walk towards it, right? Because it's the types of people that in this current system and situation we're living in at the moment that rise to the top and who are like at the top of the food chain, whether that's in big corporates or in politics or whatever, have had to turn off some of their humanity to be there, right? Like, that is the only way you could possibly get there within the current situation. That's the way organizations are set up, and that's the way, like, the world is set up, right? And so, and people who have higher EQ or whatever you want to call it, who are willing to show vulnerability, who want to collaborate over competing, who, like, all of those types of things, who are more empathetic, are often also the first to reject power, right? And I guess there are some big sweeping statements I could also make about, like, women as well, right? And, like, why they're, you know, like, the ways in, you know, I completely get, like, one of the main reason why there aren't women in those positions is because of the system, not because of the women. And also, you know, I think that it's time that we find a way to really want to be in positions of power without getting over-identified with that power, right? Like, there's a longer, more philosophical point there, but...
I think it's the thing of, like, a lot of people let the title go to their heads. I know that's having this title that will define you, that will sort of give you this power. And why particularly, geez, what's going on with me today? spoke about Obama and Mandela was because even when they weren't presidents, or even before they both became presidents, they're already, like, very strong leaders. They're very mm-hmm. strong, you know, like, it's that thing of, like, I don't need a title to actually be who I am. I'm like this anyways. So I'm going to try and you know, even right now, Barack Obama gave at the Democratic
convention.
What's it called?
Convention.
Actually gave me goosebumps, like, listening to that. And he's not, yes, he's ex-president, he's not a president, but that was like a presidential speech.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel sometimes people get stuck on titles.
Mm.
And the titles can sort of, like, oh, okay, because I'm CEO now, I need to act like this. I need to shift, you know, rattle some cages.
Yeah, I think it's, and again, it for me, it's very much about thinking about it very holistically. So it's almost like it's impossible to get there. It doesn't really matter who it is that gets there. The fact is that the system could only produce these types of results because it requires the leader to be the expert on everything. It requires the leader to look like they always have their shit together, right? It requires the leader to prioritize profit over people, right? So you know, it might as well be me or you or whoever who on a day-to-day is super empathetic that is in that position, but the system kind of pushes you into that shape, which is harmful for the person and is harmful for everyone around them, right? So I really, it's both about really shifting the structures. Sada didn't speak very much about it last week. She just kind of hinted at the fact that the Idealab team is so incredible, right? And is part of the reason for Idealab's success. But I work with Idealab behind the scenes on really thinking through the culture and how we build a really human organization on the inside of the business, right? While still making money, while still all of that stuff, right? Results and all of that stuff. Yeah. But, like, how do we really show up as we are with the permission to be who you are on that particular day? And how do Sara and Tatiana as leaders create the space for that, right? Like, you can read in the book, you can read their story, but I find so much inspiration from watching the two of them and the way that they are paying such deep attention to constructing businesses that are really human.
When you look at brands and you look at companies that you either want to engage with or buy from or use their service, more and more the consumer is becoming more conscious of, like,
yes,
who owns that company, like, you know, or where was that, you know, who made, where's that material from, you know, if it's clothing, you know, where's that come from, you know, were there, was it made in a lab that is, you know, or in a factory that is exploiting children, or
right,
whatever it is. Like, we as consumers ourselves, like, we're asking more and more questions.
Yeah, we have to demand that. I think that's really important.
Their story is in volume 2.
Yeah. Okay. Sara and Tatiana their stories in here. Other Mozambicans in here. Wasi, who you've had on the show, is in here.
Yeah.
Taila, who I think is coming on.
All the guests on our episodes in that book. Like, what's going on? Like, what's our story?
Who came first? Right. Yeah.
Where's our story now?
you all need to be next for sure. Absolutely.
No, that's amazing. It shows that it's brilliant people. It's people that are, I have a saying for people that are like Sara and like Wasis and so forth. I call them trailblazers, you know, like, they, no matter what's in the way, whatever challenges it is, still gonna stick to your guns and gonna go all in, you know. That's so important.
Yeah, I think that's really right. And what's interesting in the second volume, which is a volume of stories by African women, is we found it really difficult to put them into categories, right? So in the first volume, you'll see it's like, oh, there's a section on education and a section on healthcare and a section on, I don't know, technology. In this one, we've called them different things. So we have the influencers, we have the tech innovators, the deconstructors, the educators, the bridge builders. Because, like, all of, so think about like Wasi, right? She's a healer, designer, artist, visionary, like, blah, 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 right? Taila,
slash.
Taila is she's a designer, creative, but she's an artist, artist, and also has her association, right, which is raising awareness around sickle cell.
Yeah.
And so, like, these women just completely defied being put in categories, which is really awesome, and for sure are also pioneers and trailblazers.
Yeah, you know,
it's a great word.
I love that term. It expresses them in a great way for me.
And leave. So trailblazer leaves a trail, right? Like a shooting star or something like that right? They light the way for the rest of us.
The rest, yeah, exactly.
For sure.
Exactly. And that's great people to have. And for youngsters out there, great people to have as mentors, you know, because I also feel that, like, it's nice having a mentor that's also still going through their journey.
Yes.
I talk about it a lot because, like, there's a music program that I'm involved in, and one of the things that I love about it is the fact that we try and get mentors in that are still, so the kid that's still learning how to produce music in his room, you know, like bedroom producers, as we call them, having a mentor, what does that mean for them? For me, I find it that, like, having a mentor that is, like, you're going to bring in, like, a Kanye West to, like, mentor that kid, it's going to be so overwhelming. Like, there's a massive gap in between.
Right.
You got to have someone that is still has gotten somewhere, but hasn't reached the pinnacle yet, that is still struggling and still going through their journey, in order for that kid to actually have some sort of relation too.
Yeah.
If you make the gap too big, it's going to be lost completely.
It's overwhelming, right?
It's overwhelming. Uh-huh. And I've seen that happen.
Because that's what we do all the time, right? Yeah. Like, we compare ourselves to people who've been doing it for 20 years or to, you know, like, the greats or whatever. It's like, you know, they also had to start at some point.
Sure. Exactly. And they went through their struggles. It's so important to especially starting out, not to forget that, you know, these people have had years and years of struggles, years and years and so forth. But what's interesting to me is having someone that is sort of like going through that.
Yeah, that's relatable.
That's relatable. And they themselves will talk about this story and they'll actually feel good afterwards, and they'll actually realize the fact that they're telling their story while still going through their journey is actually beneficial to them as well.
Yeah.
It'll show them how far they've come as well, and also like keep some humility and sort of like a check of like where you're at. So it's super important. I think not just in art, but in anything.
Absolutely.
Really. Yeah. Yeah, vocês estavam a falar da Sara agora e de mentors, que nós também tivemos essa conversa durante o episódio que gravamos e ela contou um bocadinho da história dela, que como é que surgiu a ideia do Idea Lab no passeio dela por Moçambique e viu que havia, começou a identificar algumas necessidades, não é?
The Vineyard.
Yes, yes, that story. eu sei que tu tiveste um ano sabático, Sarah. And,
okay, you guys dig deep, huh?
Yeah, we do our research.
Tu tiveste um ano sabático. O que eu queria saber é se a tua necessidade de investir back in Africa foi, tu saíste com ela de Londres já, quando vieste, ou foi algo que durante o teu ano sabático reforçou isso? How did that go?
Yeah, it was the second thing, right? So I left London with all kinds of intentions to go back, right? I needed a break from London, but I thought I would go back because, you know, after 10 years in London, I felt like, you know, I'm actually probably more European now. And this is like my career trajectory looks a certain way. And this is where it's all happening, you know, the buzz. and then on the journey, what we did, I was traveling with a friend of mine. Shout out Tokes Bakery. She's also in one of the books. She runs a business in Nigeria focused on children with autism. So we ended up doing this journey, connecting the dots between all of the different people that we knew in different African countries. So like we went to Nigeria, Ghana, basically all of Southern Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, and through kind of work thing, I ended up also going to Equatorial Guinea and Congo, right? So so we got this like big picture of, you know, I feel very privileged to have been to so many African countries because I think like that's it, travel in intra-continent is rare. And so as we were doing that, we were just kind of collecting stories along the way, really. And I was like, this is where the energy is at. This is where things are happening and shifting. And I often think about Denmark, like the high street in Denmark, the main like shopping street, has looked the same since I was like 10, right? Like, okay, things change a little, but like nothing ever changes. Like they're good, you know? So I wanted to be where things were shifting and where the energy was. But also more personally, spending 2 weeks in Ghana and going back to where my father is buried and like spending time with my family there and like hearing stories about my father that I'd never heard before and really hearing like the type of work he did, how similar it is to the type of work I've ended up doing. And demonstrated to me a number of ways in which the work that I do could be of benefit here on the continent, but also that in terms of leadership and leadership development and innovation or like thinking about the future, we have so much to teach the rest of the world, right? So a lot of that was the draw. And then I ended up on a beach in Mozambique and was like, well, I'm not leaving now. Like, that would be silly, right? So yeah, that's the story of how I decided that it should be here. And I think it will continue to be here on the continent somewhere for a significant amount of time, or at the very least that this is where my impact will be.
You're also working with various organizations. You mentioned about your 9 to 5, like your day job. how did you get into that? Like, how was was that because of your philosophy degree, like as well? Or
no one gets a job after a philosophy degree. How did I get into my work? So I learned my trade in London, right? I joined a big corporate on a graduate program, which meant I got to try lots of different things within the organization, but landed in eventually in their organization development and change team, looking at how to transform the internal culture of that big multinational. And so that's really where I learned my trade. It's also where I met my mentor, who continues to be my mentor to this day. It's where I met Judith, who's co-editor of the books, co-founder of We Will Lead Africa. And so I had the skills and the intuition. Obviously, like you're always learning, and I am a lot better at what I do now than I was when I first started out. So I learned it. And I guess also coming with this like experience from big blue chip UK company, right? Like gave me some grounding to start and to go out on my own as a consultant. But how do you do it? I don't know. You just begin. And like the first kind of clients just kind of fell in my lap by chance. I don't know, like I had some conversations.
And how was that for you? Like, was it, you know, obviously I'm sure it was like quite scary, as in like, okay, like this is real now. This is like my first gig sort of thing.
Yeah, it's funny because I never really thought about myself as an entrepreneur till a bit further down the line. And was kind of just going, or I guess it's what they call a lifestyle entrepreneur. I was just going from job to job and just needed Sponging. To make yeah just yeah. just needed to make enough just to like sustain me, right? And was going where I thought that the job would be interesting. But yeah, it was scary. And I mean, like, speaking of mentors, I wouldn't be able to have done half of what I've done in my career if it weren't for my mentor. I very much believe that she has been instrumental in enabling me to take on roles that were always a little bit bigger than I thought I could do, right? So that I was always stretching and always learning, knowing that I had that support and backup of someone with a lot more experience. But more recently, owning the identity of an entrepreneur, I think that's really exciting. I'm really excited to build a homegrown, African-grown innovation consultancy that can operate at a global scale, right? And like compete right up there with the rest of them. And I'm really excited about what that next phase has in store.
Talking about working for this like multinational, like you, sometimes we look at these businesses and we're like this massive giant and all of that. But at the end of the day, it's the make or break is the people. People.
Yeah.
That's what your organization is. No matter how big you are, no matter what you sell, what services, or no matter what, it really is down to people. And if people are not, we spoke about this in the previous episode about like foundation. And if people are not buying into that foundation, mm-hmm. I think it can get lost completely. You're going to have people that are not going to be flying the flag for your organization.
Yeah,
they're
absolutely.
They're not going to believe in what they do, and that's not what you want. And it's so important to have more and more people that are teaching organizations these things. You know that it's not a. You've got to really, really ask yourself, like, what type of people do you want working here?
Yeah.
Because we all have families at home. We all have dreams. We all have nightmares, fears. Yes. Things like that. We all similar in that regard. But you know, when you're punching in the clock or going to work or at work, it's you want people that believe in that flag, believe in that motto, whatever it is that organization has.
Yeah, and I think the organization has a duty to make it a space that people want to show up in, right? I often say that I'm an organization development consultant who fundamentally disagrees with organizations, because the way we have set it up is really broken in so many ways, right? Like, people don't want that much. They want to be able to express themselves creatively. They want to probably be in touch with nature in some kind of way, like see some fresh air once in a while, right? Get feel the sun on their skin. And they want to connect with other people, right? In a meaningful way.
Yeah.
That's it. In organizations, we're not allowed to do any of those things, right? Like in most companies that you work for, you sit under like a fluorescent light all day and you're not allowed to have an opinion or about anything, right? And you don't really get on with your coworkers because the dynamic's off or you have a shit boss, right? That's how it is in so many organizations. And so for a lot of the start of my consulting career, actually, I was very frustrated by having to just make life a little bit more bearable for the people inside organizations, right? Like people would hire me to come in and be like, people aren't communicating that well, or can you do a team building, or can you? And I'm like, no, like you need to stop being a shit boss, right? Like, so that was really frustrating to me. And so I guess I've been more careful and also lucky to be able to more recently work with organizations like Idea Lab and others where there are some visionary leaders or indeed like there's a move within the organization to really radically transform as opposed to just be like, oh, we'll put some band-aids on the bits that hurt, right? And I think that's you're seeing that more and more, even within strategy, right? You're hearing people talk more about internal culture. You're hearing people talk about like toxicity in organizations and psychological safety. A lot of the talk around like diversity inclusion now, right, is about like how oppressive organizations can be for a lot of people, for people of color, for Black people, for women, right? Like, so I think we're beginning to have those conversations now, but it's not going to be an easy ride. That's for sure. It's going to be tough conversations.
O que eu acho engraçado é que nessas histórias todas que ouvimos de várias pessoas, a tua história não é diferente, Sarah, é que it feels like as pessoas têm que vir, têm que ser repats, if you know what I mean. People have to come from abroad para querer vir fazer uma diferença aqui dentro. E os que estão cá, And I hope I'm wrong about this, but it feels like the vast majority são pessoas de fora que tentam vir fazer a mudança e os que estão cá não se esforçam tanto, if you know what I mean.
I think that's just, I don't think that's particularly African. I think that's, there's always going to be a kind of bell curve, right? On the types of people you're likely to get on this podcast are people who are probably really desperate to blaze trails.
Trail blaze. Just blaze.
I don't know. So I think in general, you're going to have the vast majority of people are going to be kind of like, well, I'll just go about my day to day and like, I'm not going to try and like draw too much attention to myself and blah, 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 right? I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the human spirit, but I think that's, we kind of been numbed into that all over the world, right? I think you see that everywhere, whether you're numbing yourself with Netflix or your glass of wine at the end of the day, she says knowingly,
that's all right. You know, the two finger trick, you know?
Right. Or indeed, you're just trying to survive, right? Like you're just, you know, I'm just trying to earn a living for my kids. I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to like rock the boat. I think we've created structures that mean that it's actually quite difficult to challenge the status quo. That is the nature of the system. It doesn't want to be challenged, right? So I think it's normal. And I think that there are sparks everywhere though, right? I don't think it has to be people coming from the outside. Although sometimes when you come from the outside, like you can see things with fresh eyes and you can see a lot more of the strengths and assets and all of that stuff, right? Even like if as a coach, if I were having a conversation with you, there might be a whole chatter that you're having in your head about all the things that are wrong with you. But I might be able to hold up a mirror to some of your strengths or some of what's awesome about you in a way that you maybe can't see for yourself.
Even on this platform, like we want to get like different types of people as well, because everyone, like you say, you know, and you believe in this too. Everyone has a story. And again, like everyone has a story, and a story that we don't know, and a story that can maybe change our perspective on a lot of things, you know, because, you know, sometimes in some conversations we generalize and we don't actually know the full story until we can actually get someone that is actually from that sort of like environment or that's been or has been exposed to that different types of environments.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I hear that. And it's hard, right, to get beyond your bubble, to get the stories from outside of that. We also try to do that, right? But we're nowhere near where we'd like to be in terms of getting stories from voices that aren't usually heard, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And what would be next for We Lead Africa? Would it be workshops, or is that something that you're already thinking on, or not at all, or staying far, far away from it? Because I think that also there is I think there's a lot of people that have a story to tell,
yeah,
but just need to be unlocked. Like, you know, just need a little bit of a push or a little bit of a, not necessarily, I don't want to call it tutorial, but like,
yeah,
that can go somewhere and see that, you know, I can do this too.
Mm-hmm. What's next? Well, so we're having these conversations at the moment, and it could go in a number of different directions. But one thing is that already exists, because it's part of our vision for this to go far and wide, is a toolkit for both. If anyone wants to edit or create a volume for themselves, or indeed if they want to like host a convening, we call them griot networks. So like if anyone wants to host a conversation amongst leaders, we have some tools that people can access in order to do that. If someone in Mozambique wants to do, I want to do a volume that's just Mozambicans, or if someone in creative industries wants to do like just African creatives or just, right?
I'm thinking of doing
one. Are you in? Yes, okay.
I'm thinking of doing one. I can say it here on this platform. I'm actually thinking of doing one related to malaria. I think
yes.
A lot of people have lost loved ones with malaria, and this also has to do with my day job as well. But I feel that a lot of people have interesting stories to share about how this disease has impacted them one way or another.
Yeah, I think that's incredible, and would be a really powerful way to reframe how we think about something like that, right? I would love to talk more about that. Pin in that. what else is next? We had originally an intention to do volume 3 on tech and innovation, and that is probably still going to happen, but we are taking a different approach. So Judith and Chenge, who are co-editors of this second book with me, have started a series of conversations about tech and innovation in the African space. Again, like they will be inviting people in for conversations a little bit in the style of what you all are doing here. And then we'll take it from there, right? So we're going to see what topics emerge and then see whether or not it gets documented into a volume. So that's one direction that we're headed in.
No começo, o Age estava a falar dos nossos vizinhos, não é? Que a maior parte dos nossos vizinhos é a Commonwealth.
Uhum.
Que é speaking English countries, não é?
Uhum.
E o teu livro é em inglês,
uhum,
não é? And temos vários conceitos, várias ideias e histórias que supostamente são para inspirar e podemos make a change, não
yeah.
é? Para todos. And mas para isso acontecer nós temos que massificar, não é? Temos mais pessoas têm que ter acesso. Então, falando numa perspectiva de Moçambique, porquê que só existe em inglês? E não temos uma versão em português.
Yeah, that's a really great question. Calling all translators. If anybody would like to translate the book into any language, we would really, really welcome that. But the truth is that it's a self-published book. We're only using our own kind of resources, blood, sweat, and tears. The decision was to keep it in English, right, and to accept stories in English. But absolutely, that that prevents us from reaching a particular audience, both in terms of getting stories and also in terms of who can access it. But for sure, we'd be super interested in seeing it in all languages, Portuguese, all African languages, right? Like let's do it.
And you guys publish you self-published.
Yes. Yeah. So we had lots of conversations about what the value might be of doing it differently through traditional publishing, and reached the conclusion that they wouldn't be able to reach a lot of Africa anyway, the traditional publishers. And so this was a kind of easy and accessible way for us to do it and to not have to print loads of stock, right? Like it gets printed on demand.
What do you think about that in terms of, I mean, a lot of things are happening in this world of ours, which is amazing in terms of a lot of disruptions. So you name it, the Netflix, you name it, Ubers, mm-hmm. and so forth. But from a publishing point of view, especially now that I look at other industries like music and so forth, you have an industry that's also been disrupted by, you know, streaming and, you know, labels losing less power. The label in this case would be the book publisher. Do you think it's much easier now to self-publish than it was before? Because, you know, now you have all these tools available and you can have access to so much. When making a book, it's not just about making a book, it's how more you're going to market the book as mm-hmm. well. Because, you want more people to reach it. And, you know, if you take the money part aside, you want more people to be exposed to whatever it is that you're producing. And you know, this is my opinion. I kind of feel that it's much easier now. Like, you're getting a lot of people doing even like ebooks as well, going on that route. I'm a sucker for like print and hard copy. We hard copy people on this podcast. I kind of feel that it's much easier. Was it easy for you to like produce this book? Were there challenges? Were there, apart from getting the stories in?
The hardest part for sure is gathering the stories, but that's also the part that brings most joy, right? So that's fine. The hardest part that brings least joy when you self-publish is that you also have to do all the work of like editing and formatting and blah, 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 all of this, and then you just upload the thing, right? But the actual process of self-publishing, I think, is really, really an awesome resource for people. And for sure, not just in the publishing, like book publishing space, but in all kinds of industries, I think that it's positive in many ways, right? The access that people are able to have to be able to document how and share however they want to do that, whether that's voice or writing. I also think it means that there's obviously a more crowded space, right? And a lot of stuff that is not necessarily as awesome, right? That you have to kind of churn through. The other thing that I've been reflecting on with COVID, I don't know if you felt this, but I certainly felt that, particularly at the start, it was like, oh, everything is now a webinar, and actually I have less time because I want to sign up to all of these things, right? So I suspect that there might be something happening where everybody has the tools to broadcast, but no one's listening.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm like, what?
I think you read our minds.
And I think that that's sad. So what I would love to see is, how does this become more of a dialogue? How do we start to connect stories, create space to not only speak, but to hear each other? Because I think that's where the innovation is going to happen, right? Like, that's where we're going to really unlock the potential, is when we begin to connect the stories, as opposed to everybody just being like, give me some space on the platform, right? Like, we need to connect the dots.
That's one of the sort of kind of downsides of the, sort of the digital / social media space, is that we rely so much on platforms. We're even talking about it today, on platforms that have their algorithm.
Right, as well. And those can be biased, right?
Just going to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
or can decide that your post could be seen by many people and
not worthy.
Oh yeah, not worthy.
and usually it doesn't have very much to do with whether or not the content is awesome or not, right? Like there's the algorithms are set up to usually to make money, right?
Yeah. So then
and then that means
pay.
It's biased, yeah.
Yeah, it forces
in lots
you to do promoted posts and all these different things in order for you to be seen by whatever audience you're trying to target. So but I agree with you completely. It's become really overwhelming. There's like seminar, webinar after webinar, and I've been in some of them, and some of them are actually, you know, fantastic and great. My thing is that I already get fatigued with Zoom and Google Hangouts and Microsoft Teams and doing meetings that way. I kind of feel at the end of the day I'm more fatigued than it would be on a normal, you know, when life was different before. This year.
But I think you all are onto something, and I think that there's always a space for good content. People are looking for it. And I think you're onto something because this is a conversation, right? And it is about connecting dots much more. It feels wholesome meaningful, and I'm feeling very energized about it.
Thank you.
I hope that the people listening to it find that too. I feel that way when I listen to it as well, right? It feels very wholesome.
That's fantastic. And thank you for that. All we've really got to say to people is having conversations offline with people that have approached us and saying that they want to start their own podcast and all of that. And we're open to giving advice. You know, the one thing that I would say to anyone is you've also got to be dedicated to doing it. This is not a trend thing.
Yeah.
This is not like the now that everyone is doing this digital thing. For you to really, really stand out and start growing, you really need to be dedicated to
it. And consistent.
Otherwise, it's just going to fall flat. It's going to fall flat completely. And it takes a lot of work to do it. So you got to really ask yourself, just like you would with anything you'd want to get into, how serious you are, how serious you want to take it, and so forth. And there's lots of room. There's lots of room to. There's some people that, you know, want to do podcasts on talking about feminism. Others want to do podcasts talking about movie reviews. Others want to do podcasts about music reviews, and I find that fantastic, you know.
And
I think more and more, like, more podcasts from this side of the world are gonna start it's so important to consume our own things.
Let's
call it that. Consuming our own things for me is something that is very strong. I love my series and the movies that I get from Hollywood and all of that. Like, yes, I have space for it, but I'm also curious about my own country. I'm curious about my own region, South Africa, Botswana, you know, Malawi, Zimbabwe, like other African countries. Like me as a human being, as an African, as a Mozambican, I'm also curious to know what's out there that hasn't been shown. And to the content creators, keep creating, keep coming up with great ideas.
Absolutely.
We came up with this idea and we're going to go with it.
Yeah.
And Sarah, where can what's your ads? Do you have any hashtags? Do you have a website? You know, yeah. Because the other day I asked the question, like, where can people find you? Well, you can find me at home.
Where everyone is at the moment.
Ask that question.
Okay, so We Will Lead Africa, both the volumes. You can buy both Kindle and the hard copy on Amazon, and we are on all of the
and
social
Amazon
medias.
Delivers to Mozambique, by the way.
It does.
Whoever wants to order.
I think it takes some time, though, right? Yeah. So
Marcia has more experience with this stuff.
Be ready for a wait, but it does arrive. We're also on all the social medias. The second thing I spoke about was Collateral Benefits, which are the perspective papers about this particular moment we're living in. We're also on all of the social medias and have a website, collateralbenefits.africa. And then my day job, innovation consulting, is called InkDot. And we have a website, theinkdot.com.
InkDot.com. It's amazing. And don't forget, you can also listen to this episode, which you're listening to right now. I don't know if you're listening to it on Kubula.com, but Kubula.com is also available right now. Yeah. Yeah, I won't put the noise thing.
Not again.
And thanks to everyone that has given us feedback on the website, on the new visual identity. And big shout out to Ricardo Pinto-Jorge.
Is that who did it?
Yeah.
Amazing. And he's in he's in volume one.
Yeah,
he's We're in all volume surrounded one. By these awesome
yeah,
people.
These awesome people, yeah. These trailblazers. And he's a trailblazer, artist, great human being, pilot.
Pilot, right.
He's jack of all trades, man, and master of many.
Mm.
Also big shout out to my wife, Joanna, who also worked with me on the website. So, it's just dope. Surrounded by amazing people, and hopefully people can continue to enjoy our episodes. So, Sarah, thank you for coming to join us here in our little platform.
Agora fazes parte da nossa história.
Yeah, now you're part of the alumni.
Yeah, thank you so much. Such a pleasure. You two are definitely an inspiration and definitely everyday leaders. We would love to capture your story in a future volume. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We out.
And we out.